You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 26th of March, 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. It's 9 a.m. in Jerusalem, 8 a.m. in Paris, 7 a.m. here in London and midnight in Seattle. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Globalist starts now. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
14 votes in favour, 0 vote against, 1 abstention.
The UN Security Council passes a vote for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. We'll get the reaction. Washington and Tokyo agree to upgrade security ties in the light of increased regional unrest. We'll have the details. We'll ask if the Franco-German alliance is broken and what that might mean for Ukraine. And we'll have a look at how Boeing is restructuring and if it's enough to rebuild trust in the company. We'll have a rustle through the papers, a roundup of tech news and...
I greatly respect the decision of the appellate division, and I'll post either $175 million in cash or bonds or security or whatever is necessary very quickly within the 10 days.
A reprieve for Donald Trump as he narrowly avoids confiscation of his assets, but a criminal trial date has been set for peak campaign time. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Taiwan tested its air defences early this morning, using surface-to-air missiles and air, land and naval forces, saying it would continue to intensify training in the face of China's frequent military activities nearby. Senegal opposition presidential candidate Bassirou Diomaye Faye is set to be declared the next president after his main rival called him to concede defeat. And US and British officials have filed charges, imposed sanctions and accused Beijing of a sweeping cyber espionage campaign that allegedly hit millions of people, including lawmakers, academics and journalists and companies, including defence contractors. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, on Monday, the United Nations Security Council, UNSC, finally voted for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian group Hamas in the Gaza Strip during the remainder of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan and the release of all captives. The resolution was proposed by 10 elected members of the council, voted for by 14 members, but the United States abstained. Well, I'm joined now by Hannah McCarthy, who's a journalist in Jerusalem. Hannah, many thanks for joining us here on The Globalist. It's been a long journey to get to this point, 5 months or so. Can you chart the progress of this resolution?
Sure. So this is not the first time that the UN Security Council has voted on a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. But this is the first time that the US has not used its veto, which it has as a permanent member of the UN Security Council, against that resolution. And again, throughout, you know, its time on the UN Security Council, it has used its veto largely in favor of Israel. So this is a remarkable departure in US policy at the UN towards Israel. It is seen as a public criticism of the direction that Netanyahu has taken Israel's policy in relation to Gaza. And again, they have abstained, and they said they abstained because there wasn't a condemnation of Hamas. And that's why they didn't vote for it. Again, it would be quite an even stronger message if they had voted for it. But it's certainly sending a strong message. Netanyahu has already criticized this resolution. He said that this will be a departure from the US's position in support of the war, and it will make it easier for, you know, Hamas to succeed. And he said it will make it harder to release the hostages.
What does it mean in practice? Will fighting stop? Is it enforceable?
So this is the interesting debate that's happening. So after the vote, the US ambassador to the UN noted that, in their view, the resolution was not binding. The UN Security Council is the most powerful decision-making body in the UN, and its resolutions are viewed as international law. However, it doesn't necessarily have a direct mechanism to enforce that law, so it does rely on member states to abide by these resolutions. However, it would be open to it to vote for sanctions against Israel. Again, that's not necessarily on the immediate cards and would be quite a strong departure from anything we've seen in the past.
What's been the readout from Palestine?
They are supportive of the ceasefire. I think there is kind of cautious hope that, you know, there could be a cessation of the conflict. At the same time, Israel has not publicly said that it's going to stand by this resolution. Netanyahu cancelled a delegation, an Israeli delegation that was visiting the White House this week. However, the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, is there at the moment and will be, you know, in negotiations with high-level members of the White House.
I mean, so it looks like talks are still going on, but I wonder what the implications are of going forward for that US-Israel relationship.
Well, you know, I think what's also important to notice is that while, you know, this is quite a public rebuke to Israel, what happened on Monday, at the same time on Monday, the US said that it had received written assurances from Israel that the military aid that the US was sending to Israel is being used in a way that is in compliance with international law. Several human rights NGOs have said that the US should not be exporting arms to Israel based on its conduct of the war in Gaza. So the US has said that it has received written assurances and that we have not, and, you know, the US State Department official said, we have not found Israel to be in violation of international humanitarian law. So that was happening, you know, at the same time as that UN Security Council vote. So we're not necessarily seeing, you know, a complete change in US policy towards Israel yet.
And what about humanitarian aid getting through? I mean, there are all sorts of reports about impending famine in Gaza.
Well, again, there was extremely stark warnings, you know, from, you know, all the UN agencies who are delivering aid in Gaza. And what we're seeing is there are significant chokeholds in the supply chain of aid going into Gaza. There's not enough land crossings open. I spoke with the UN humanitarian coordinator to Palestine at the weekend, and he said, you know, we need to, you know, put these flotillas and these airdrops in context. If Israel does not open more land crossings and ensure a stronger supply from Jordan, the situation will not improve immediately. Rafah and airdrops and flotillas, like we saw from the World Central Kitchen, are just there a band-aid.
If this ceasefire can be enforced, if it does go ahead, it's only valid until the end of Ramadan. That's about 2 weeks. What happens after that?
Well, so the wording of the resolution does suggest that it calls for an immediate ceasefire that could then lead to a more permanent ceasefire. So it didn't call for a permanent ceasefire, but it certainly suggested that, you know, in this kind of 2 week period, that there could be further negotiations to make it more permanent. Again, what happened in the last ceasefire is that, you know, there was a pause in hostilities and then Israel resumed its bombing campaign. So, you know, we're in uncharted territory. There are obviously still negotiations going on in Qatar around the release of the hostages and the release of Palestinian prisoners. So again, all of that is still underway in the background.
And do we know any further detail about plans for the ground offensive in Rafah?
So again, the Israeli delegation that was going to the White House was supposed to be discussing the Rafah offensive. Netanyahu has continued to say that whether there is a ceasefire or not, Israel will continue with an operation in Rafah. There has been fairly universal condemnation of that plan. The US has said that it's not confident that Israel will be able to protect civilians, 1.5 million of them who are based in Rafah, if they did conduct that operation. And they are discussing alternative plans with Israel and options that they could do to target Hamas.
I see that another member of Israel's government has resigned. Is that significant at all?
It will put more pressure on centrist figures in the cabinet to consider their position. There have been calls by protesters for Israel to hold elections. People say Netanyahu needs to go. And again, we saw a kind of remarkable speech from U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer, you know, a staunch ally of Israel, saying that Israel is on the wrong path and Netanyahu needs to go. There needs to be a change of government in a very, very strong speech.
You're in Jerusalem. What's the mood there now?
Again, I think there's growing protests. There's calls for Netanyahu to leave office. I think there's deep frustration with the government. Again, the scale of the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza isn't necessarily being broadcast on Israeli media. And again, there are questions. We see questions over how the UN compiled their data on the risk of famine. There isn't necessarily a full public awareness of the scale of the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, but there is certainly quite convincing public condemnation of Netanyahu and a serious sense that this is not a man that can lead Israel.
Hannah, thank you very much indeed. That's Hannah McCarthy there, and this is The Globalist. It is 16:10 in Tokyo, 7:10 here in London. In the biggest shake-up of the 1960 mutual defence treaty between the US and Japan, the two countries are planning a huge upgrade to their security alliance. Plans will be formalised when Prime Minister Fumio Kishida visits the White House next month. Well, I'm joined now by Tomohiko Taniguchi, who's former special advisor to the cabinet of Shinzo Abe. Many thanks for coming back on the programme, Tomohiko. Why is this joint upgrade necessary?
Huge may that be, but the plan has been long in the pipeline on the Japanese side. A, because there has been no joint consolidated command structure overlapping and across the services of land, air, and sea on the Japanese side. B, because there has been no corresponding command function on the U.S. side as well. Alliance is what the United States and Japan have been bound together. But when it comes to military command, there has been no nerve center. And Kishida and Biden are going to establish that, which I should say has been discussed for a long time.
Right. So, but this then is happening at an organizational level. Is there going to be any more interoperability between their equipment? Will there be an investment in equipment and so on?
When it comes to interoperability, the two nations have come to a point where everything that is under control of these services is interoperable, and the information link that binds these three services on each side has been upgraded as well. So it's not actually an issue. It's more about an organizational structure. It's more about creating a brain center.
So how does that liaison work at the moment?
It is going to give a strong, powerful message, obviously, to the gray rhino in the room. That's China. And China is encircling at this point in time Jinmen Islands that are distant from the Chinese mainland only by 3 kilometers. That's been under the firm and administrative control of Taiwan. So that's a crisis present and unfolding. So the time is not on the side of the Japanese and American side. Now is the time for the two nations to give a strong, powerful deterrence signal to the Chinese side by building a strong command, joint command and consolidated function.
Do you have any detail on the new fighter jets Japan's developing with Italy and the UK? And is that part of this programme?
That's not actually part of the programme, but the programme itself, called Global Combat Air Programme, GCAP, has been very much endorsed by the US side, and the interoperability between the 6th fighter jet, which is going to be produced by this GCAP program, and the corresponding fighter on the US side is going to be fully and firmly promised. So it's not actually an issue to be discussed by Biden and Kishida.
Is this a significant move away from Japan's pacifist policies?
This is certainly a significant move, simply because the neighbourhood you're looking at is one of the most precarious.
We're talking there, of course, about the islands, as you say. What are some of the other challenges, the regional challenges?
Regional challenges are rampant because in the neighbourhood of the Japanese archipelago are three nations of Russia, North Korea, China, none of which has exercised anything akin to democracy, and every one of those has developed a quite significant capacity of nuclear arsenal and launching and carrying facilities like intermediate range missiles and so on. So that's what's propelling Japan and the United States to upgrade their deterrence capacities.
Mm. It's been reported that Kishida is exploring the possibility of meeting North Korea's Kim Jong-un. What more do we know about that?
It's a different but even more emotive issue in 1977, then 13-year-old girl, Japanese girl, went missing, and it turned out she got kidnapped by North Korea. If alive, she would be 60 years old, and her mother has already turned 88. And if Kishida has any clue that this lady, now 60 years old, is alive and North Korea is willing to bring her back, that's going to be a big accomplishment. But so far, no assurance has been made available.
But is there any plan then for some kind of a political agreement beyond the fact of this missing woman?
It's very much a precarious sort of things. Kishida has to walk a tight balance. There is actually no need for Japan to help build North Korea's nuclear and missile capabilities at this point without any quid pro quo. Even with quid pro quo, what Japan could do is to be judged in the context whereby security situations in the Indo-Pacific are becoming even more serious.
So if Japan does cozy up with North Korea, would that mean difficulties with China, who are, of course, staunch supporters of Kim Jong-un?
I don't think so, because North Korea does not think that it is a weak nation. It's been on demand, believe it or not, by Russia, by Iran, as regards North Korea's military capabilities. And North Korea's economy was bad and is not good, but it's okay. People are not starving as before, and Kim Jong-un's regime seems to be stable. And so Kim Jong-un's North Korea does not necessarily view that Japan is strong, therefore North Korea must make compromise. North Korea has been supported by the lifelines provided by China. So all combined, they think they are able to give upper hands over Japan.
Mm. And just finally, back to this U.S.-Japanese relationship, we know that there's been some tension between the two countries over steel. What's the detail on that? Could it affect the military arrangements we've been speaking of?
Not directly, but it's more like a national symbol of the United States faced with the challenges from Japan. U.S. automobile manufacturers have had difficulties. No consumer electronics companies are existing anymore in the United States, faced with the challenges from Japan. Now, steel, U.S. steel, is almost synonymous to the United States' industrial might. And when it comes to the Rust Belt and Bible Belt and workers of high school graduates, and you know, U.S. steel symbolizes the pride and long history of industrial America. So it's more about politics rather than about market mechanisms.
Tomohiko, thank you very much indeed. That's Tomohiko Taniguchi. Still to come on the programme.
I greatly respect the decision of the Appellate Division, and I'll post either $175 million in cash or bonds or security or whatever is necessary very quickly within the 10 days.
We'll hear all about Mr. Trump's travails in a moment. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is Robin Brandt, who's the BBC's former China correspondent. Good morning to you, Robin.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Very lovely to have you here in the studio. Horrified to see that the Daily Mail is one of your sources. But lots of people are talking about this problem between China and the UK and the US in terms of cybercrime. Tell us more.
Yes, despite your disgust, it's not just the Daily Mail that has a headline similar to this morning. Other UK papers and others in New Zealand and the US as well reflecting this morning. I think reaction from coordinated reaction from UK, US and now Kiwi governments as well in Wellington overnight. And what we're seeing is an attempt by these governments to calibrate a coordinated response to what they believe is malign efforts by Xi Jinping's government, the Communist Party of China, and its many, many organs to undermine democracy and our political life in this country. Now, the Daily Mail talks about a feeble response as it sees it. I think that's reflecting some of the views of the ruling Conservative Party members of Parliament who believe what they heard from the UK's Deputy Prime Minister yesterday was nowhere near enough. But what fascinates me as someone who lived in Shanghai for almost 7 years and reported for that country for a long, long time is the relationship between Beijing, Washington and the UK in particular went through radical change, is seeing how these governments are trying to calibrate their response. They're trying to coordinate it. At the same time, though, there is intense pressure from business leaders, from those in commerce. If you're a Diageo, if you're a Jaguar Land Rover, if you're a Burberry, the last thing you want to see is anything that you believe coming from your government is going to make the relationship between China a vast and growing market and your government that's making that relationship a more difficult and a more testy one. So what fascinates me is the politics, the international relations, but underneath as well, the commercial and global trade relations, all very important factors.
And what exactly is China being accused of here?
Cyber hacking, something, I mean, you were talking about North Korea a little earlier, the global leaders in cyber hacking, but hacking on an industrial scale. This isn't just about industrial espionage. This isn't just about stealing secrets from some more advanced companies to try and improve what your companies can do. But this is about stealing information. This instance in the UK refers to claims by the UK government that Chinese government-related entities were hacking vast amounts of detail on the Electoral Commission that give details of millions and millions of people in the UK who vote and use that information along with other information they're trying to gather almost certainly illegally as well to give them access to people. Not just people in government, not just people in politics, but people in crucial areas of industry in this country as well, in academia as well. All, the UK government says, aimed at trying to undermine some of the institutions in this country and in some instances as well, target specific people or target specific companies that China believe are antagonistic, maybe a polite way of describing, antagonistic to what the Chinese government is doing in China and also in Hong Kong.
And the response has been very weak. I mean, they're saying that, what have they sanctioned? Two individuals and one company.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking over the past couple of days as well with some colleagues about a conversation I had with, she's still the UK ambassador in Beijing, Caroline Wilson, in the very early days of her role back in 2020. And we sat down in a conversation like this and I I said to her, what about the sometimes the measures that some governments use, in particular the US government at the time, to signal their disdain, to signal their displeasure, was to target people who were in their country, often falsely under things like journalist visas. The State Department was rowing back on the number of visas it was giving to some Chinese journalists, in inverted commas. And I said, is the UK looking at doing this kind of thing? Does it believe there are people who are in the UK, they work for the Chinese government or they work for arms of the state, who maybe aren't there under the auspices that they say they are? And what I was getting at here was using the visa regime, using much more other specific measures to punish and to go public with some of these malign activities that you believe the Chinese are carrying out. At the time, she was nonplussed. She didn't believe it was something the UK government should be looking at. But what we saw yesterday, 4 years on from Oliver Dowden, the Deputy Prime Minister, is specific measures to target one or two people and some organisations. Now, the Chinese government won't like that. They won't like the fact that they're being called out on it. But what I found most interesting was, as I say, an attempt to recalibrate the relationship. But the coordinated effort is the most significant here thing, I think, because the way these governments believe they can tackle China is together. Mm. It's a vast economy. It's a vast country. It's hugely powerful. It's hugely influential. And the only way that the UK, certainly post-Brexit, is going to be able to have an effect and possibly influence any kind of change in Beijing is doing it alongside the United States, doing it alongside the European Union maybe as well, and its historic allies like New Zealand.
Yeah. Let's move on to the New York Times. Now, they've released this fascinating video showing Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil hiding at the Hungarian embassy. Tell us more.
Now, he says, I was there for a couple of days to speak to Hungarian colleagues. He's close to Viktor Orban, we are led to believe. And if this was to talk politics, this was to talk policy. The New York Times doesn't quite believe that. It thinks this evidence, this video evidence is proof of an attempt by Bolsonaro to maybe seek asylum, to escape the criminal justice process in Brazil in the days after acolytes of his and some aides were being arrested on a whole range of accusations, from corruption, from falsifying COVID-19 certificates, but of course most significantly of being involved in what some believe was an attempt at a coup in Brazil after Bolsonaro lost the presidential election in 2022. I mean, we see this video footage of a car of what appears to be him coming into the Hungarian embassy in Brasilia. He stays there for a couple of days. The New York Times seeks to corroborate and seeks to verify its reporting with satellite imagery and proof, it says, of his presence there. And it joins the dots together to say that this was a man who was seeking political asylum at the time. Of course, it implies that by going to a foreign embassy, albeit in his home country, that he was beyond the reach of Brazil's police and beyond the reach of Brazil's criminal justice system. It didn't last very long. He left after a couple of days. But look, yet again, we have evidence, maybe not quite so dramatic as what Donald Trump is facing in the United States, of leaders who were in office, who left office, and are now facing a whole coterie of accusations, the most serious of which, you know, inciting or maybe even leading insurrections in this country. And in this instance, Jair Bolsonaro sought to find support and maybe even seek asylum in what he believed was the embassy of a friendly country. But seeing the video evidence is fascinating.
Mm, absolutely. And really, he should be under no illusion that this is going to go away anytime soon, because if we look across to Singapore, we see that despite his huge age, he's 98 now, the former Malaysian PM is still being probed.
I mean, Dr. Mahathir, a man I interview when I lived in Malaysia back in 2008, at the top of the top of the Petronas Towers, those twin towers in Kuala Lumpur. He had an office right at the very top. It was classic kind of Bond baddie style setting, and I interviewed him. He is a truly iconic leader, not just in Malaysia but across that part of Southeast Asia, going right back to the time when his premiership began in 1981. He is 98 now. He's been in hospital recently recently for over 50 days for treatment for an ongoing heart condition. But his two sons say that he is yet again subject to a corruption probe by Malaysia's anti-corruption authorities at the age of 98. His sons claim they've been asked to bring together evidence relating back to 1981. They say it's impossible. It's a task they couldn't possibly complete. But what it is yet fresh evidence that maybe the authorities, the criminal justice system, will continue to pursue you till the very dying days of your life, and not just your political career, but also a reminder of the rivalries that we have in Malaysia. The country's current Prime Minister, Anwar Ibrahim, he was at one time a protege of Dr. Mahathir, but he was dismissed from all office in the mid-90s. He himself was accused of sodomy, of corruption. He went to prison. He is now the country's Prime Minister, under a different political flag. Some say this is evidence of vengeance, of the beginning of a payback. But what fascinates me is not just the age. At the age of 98, Dr. Mahathir is facing these accusations and facing these questions. But yet again, the rivalry between these two leaders in particular, who at one time were so close, in a country, Malaysia, which is known in the region for its stability, its political stability. It's becoming increasingly important in terms of its economy and the microprocessor supply chain as well. And yet what underpins it is a politics of a racial politics and ethnic politics. And in the most recent generation, a bitter rivalry between a former prime minister and the country's current prime minister.
Mm. Let's end with some good news, I think, from Senegal, where there's been a shock victory. But in West Africa, which has been beset by coups, this is really good news.
Yeah, I mean, look at the map. You know, Senegal, Liberia as well, a country I reported from back in 2004, and a whole coterie of nations around there, where you say we have become used to hearing better news recently, but the history is one of violence, of civil wars, and certainly one where transfers of power between democratic governments has not been what you might describe as a persistent symbol of governments, of democracy in that part of the world. But nonetheless, we have good news from Senegal over the weekend, where it looks like the incumbent ruling party have conceded defeat. The first round of the presidential elections, delayed presidential elections, I might add, gave the opposition leader, he's just 44, a sizable lead. And it now looks like that the incumbent government and their candidate have conceded defeat. And we will get a transition from a ruling party to a new opposition leader, an opposition leader who was in jail facing various charges just a matter of weeks ago. But a peaceful transition in a country where youthful democracy, it seems, has been the main reason behind why we're seeing this change of government. You know, that's something that we haven't been reporting on a lot in that part of the world, but increasingly we're hearing better news. And just one last thing, you know, Africa, sub-Saharan Africa in particular, and its trend of an increasingly youthful votership, an increasingly youthful number of people who are going to become crucial in elections in that part of the world, is fascinating in terms of the shift there. And Senegal is the most recent example of how important those younger voters, when they choose to come out, are.
Absolutely. And we look to South Africa for major changes there later this year. Robin Brandt, thank you very much indeed. Here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Russia and Western countries have traded barbs over a deadly attack by gunmen that killed 137 people in a concert hall outside Moscow. The US and other Western officials say they had intelligence linking it to an Islamic State branch and pointed to a warning they gave before the attack. Moscow said the attack was tied to Kyiv, a charge that Ukraine denied. Four suspects have been charged with acts of terrorism in a district court, all citizens of the ex-Soviet Republic of Tajikistan. Taiwan tested its air defences early this morning using surface-to-air missiles and air, land and naval forces, saying it would continue to intensify training in the face of China's frequent military activities nearby. A defence ministry spokesperson said that although there was no direct link between what he called routine annual drills such as these and current tensions, the threat from Russia was continuing to rise. And Senegal opposition presidential candidate Bassirou Diomaye Faye is set to be declared the next president after his main rival called him to concede defeat. A peaceful transition of power in Senegal would mark a boost for democracy in West Africa, where there have been 8 military coups since 2020. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Franco-German relationship is not in a good way. There are reports of a personality clash between the leaders, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and President Emmanuel Macron of France, and this could pose serious problems for Europe. Well, I'm joined now by Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, who is a French journalist and a columnist for the Daily Telegraph. Anne's written a brilliant piece about the souring of this partnership. Anne-Elisabeth, in your piece, you take us back to a meeting last October. Bring out the story from there.
There's consciousness between Paris and Berlin that things are not quite optimal. And so they decided to have something that was more of a team meeting and sort of getting to know and how to work together. And that was to bring almost the entire French cabinet and to have them meet their German counterparts. And Mr. Macron, Mr. Scholz and wives were also there. And the whole thing was in Hamburg. Because Olaf Scholz is from Hamburg. He was actually the first Burgmeister of Hamburg, that's the mayor, for several years. And everybody was very dutiful and everybody said this was going to work out. And it's not the first time that they said it's going to work out, but it didn't really work out. And symbolically, it rained on their boat trip in the harbour. Mr. and Mrs. Scholz took Mr. and Mrs. Macron to eat something which is called Fischbrötchen, which is a kind of sow herring sandwiches. And you could see the sow faces eating the sow herrings.
Yes.
And in general, it was less than optimal because it looked like something some consultant would have dreamt up. You know, your company is not terribly happy. They decide that everybody is going to be jolly or else. And it gave the same result as what consultants do to you when you don't really feel like it.
So what are the major issues that the two countries disagree on?
The major issues, there are several. I mean, there have been for a very long time. There has been since practically the 50s when Reconstruction and the French-German alliance was something that was fostered by General de Gaulle and Chancellor Adenauer. And the idea was we had two wars and three wars in the case of the French and possibly and Germans. And now is the time not to have it again. And it was, this is what gave birth to the French-German axis within the European, what was at the time the beginning to be the common market. And before that, it was the steel and coal community. And for decades, it worked with presidents as different as de Gaulle and Mitterrand and chancellors who were usually of the opposite stripe. For instance, Mitterrand was a socialist. He had lived through the Second World War. And his counterpart, Helmut Kohl, was in the same case. And they got along extremely well. Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, a conservative, did very well with Helmut Schmidt, a social democrat again. I mean, it happened again. And then slowly, as Germany took assurance and didn't need to apologize for her past any longer and became the economic powerhouse of Europe, there you started being the sort of role playing in which the French, who are a nuclear power, who are the permanent member of the Security Council, would take the political lead and the Germans would take the economic lead. And that's how they built the euro as well. Mm-hmm. But now the memory of the war is a bit behind us. The Germans are a powerhouse as an economy. They have missed AI. They have missed the new economy. That's not their thing. They do mechanical things that work. They feel that they do not get the role that they are. They may also, with the war in Ukraine, that changed everything. They used to have an area of influence in Eastern Europe because that was traditional. But the Eastern Europeans are now worried about Ukraine and they're worried that Germany is sending hardware, but not doing anything politically. And Emmanuel Macron took 2 years to realize that the threat from Russia was important enough, and he's trying to get the Russians, he's trying to get the Germans to agree. And Chancellor Scholz is digging his heels in. He's not sending Taurus, the long distance missiles, to Ukraine, which Ukraine desperately need. That was the same kind of thing with the Leopard tanks. And now we see something that had been evolving in Germany since the 80s, which is the extremely targeted pacifism of Germany. Germany from the 70s and 80s was a country that was opposed to sort of doing anything that would change an almost neutral political stance in Europe. And it said that it was because of her past, but there were massive demonstrations in when Olaf Scholz was marching against nuclear energy, civilian or military. And now it's the same thing. And Olaf Scholz has a past as somebody who was more of a sort of the German equivalent of a Grinham Common woman than anything else. So he doesn't gel with Emmanuel Macron.
Yeah. Just quickly before we go, Anne-Elisabeth, what are the ramifications then for Ukraine?
The ramifications for Ukraine are quite honestly awful. The Germany, after waiting for a bit and sending helmets and stuff, because that was defensive, we didn't want to offend the Russians, whose economy whose gas they need, whose energy they need. Ukraine didn't get the weapons that it needed when it needed them, and that really has been disastrous in terms of how Ukraine is defending herself against Russians, because we were, and I say we, Europe, we were denying them the weapons they needed at the time they needed, and now they're receiving 6 to 8 months later stuff that unfortunately is no longer adapted to the stage of the war. When they needed tanks, we didn't give them tanks. When they needed planes, we gave them tanks. And when they needed long-range missiles, we started saying that possibly we might sell planes, and that is a true problem.
Anne-Elisabeth Moutet in Paris, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist. Get a check-in about the latest goings-on in the management of troubled Boeing. I'm joined now by Paul Charles, the founder and CEO of the PC agency and former director of Virgin Atlantic and Eurostar. Paul, many thanks for coming on. Is this a complete management restructure after the disasters we've seen, the safety disasters we've seen at Boeing?
I think it's more than a management restructure. This is a fundamental watershed moment, as the outgoing CEO of Boeing said yesterday. This is about totally reshaping Boeing. There has been a loss of trust by airlines in Boeing and by passengers as well, of course, after that infamous incident involving Alaska Airlines and the mid-air blowout of a passenger door. And that has spooked a lot of people. And it's led to this breakdown in trust, which ultimately the senior management are having to pay the price for.
Mm. So tell us, what exactly is changing within that structure?
Well, three of the senior management are being jettisoned. So you're seeing the chairman leave immediately, the CEO, Dave Calhoun, who promised to fix the problems at Boeing, will be leaving by the end of this year. Actually, that in reality means he'll be leaving very shortly because somebody else is taking over in the interim. And the president of the core division, Boeing Commercial, will also be leaving. So all that expertise, which has led to Boeing's downfall reputationally, will be out the door pretty well straight away. On top of that, there'll be various other changes involving production and potentially manufacturing facilities as well.
And the replacements, are they lined up? Are they competent people? Are they close to the company already?
Well, I think they're going to be seeking an outsider to come in as the new CEO. There are many competent people in Boeing, but sadly their voices have not been heard. And so I think to restore trust, and that's what Boeing has to do, it has to rebuild trust very quickly among its core customers, the airlines, and they'll need to look outside to bring someone in. But they've got to fix the reputational issues of Boeing. It has had a litany of errors, which are very damaging, which are now leading to FBI investigations, Federal Aviation Administration investigations, and they've got to somehow put in place a five-year plan, and it will take that long, to rebuild that trust.
How's the industry reacted to this speech, this powerful speech by the CEO, talking of the restructure?
Well, it was his last speech, really. So, yes, powerful, but it hasn't, you know, he hasn't fixed the issues. And he promised to, even after the Alaska Airlines incident, and of course, post those high profile MAX crashes, which sadly left 350 people dead as a result of those crashes some years ago. The industry feels that, yes, there could be a turning point, but it depends who they bring in. There are all sorts of names being touted who come from outside the aviation industry. And I think they will need someone from outside aviation. They need someone who understands high quality production lines. They need someone who understands the core values of safety, which obviously Boeing has lost over the last few months, especially. And they need someone who's going to rebuild that confidence very, very quickly. Mm. It's not easy finding a CEO who can match all of those at the moment.
And in light of the news of the restructure, has the share price moved at all?
Well, actually, Boeing shares went up yesterday, which is a sign that investors feel that these are the right moves, that you have to move management on. It became quite clear that Dave Calhoun, as the CEO, was not able to rebuild that trust himself. And so it became very clear in the last few days, especially after some of the airlines in the US requested a meeting without him, with the chairman of the company, that he had to go. So the market feels, yes, that's the right thing to do. But just look at Boeing. They have 10,000 aircraft operating around the world. Airbus has 13,700. Airbus seemingly has done a better job in retaining trust, building confidence, rolling out good quality production facilities and planes. So Boeing has a lot of catching up to do, and that's going to be a five-year process. It's not going to happen overnight.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. That's Paul Charles there. This is Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter, to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 8:47 in Zurich, 3:47 in New York. And on Monday, former US President Donald Trump won a bid to pause a $454 million civil fraud judgment by pledging to post a bond of $175 million within 10 days. This prevents the New York authorities from seizing his assets. However, within the same hour, another court set a date for a trial to start at the heart of the campaign season. Well, Scott Lucas is an adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute, University College Dublin, and joins me down the line from the Republic of Ireland. Scott, lovely to speak to you again. He has many legal issues, good news on the one side, very bad news on the other. Let's talk about the civil fraud judgment in New York. What are the facts of this case and what's been agreed?
Well, the facts are is that Donald Trump, of course, was convicted earlier this year in a civil case of widespread business fraud, and was ordered to pay a fine of more than $350 million. When you add the interest on that fine and other payments, including fines against his sons, Eric and Donald Jr., then it's a total of $464 million that he had to pay. the deadline to come up with a bond. In other words, an insurance company saying that Trump was good for the money was on Monday. No insurance company would finance him, despite the fact he claims to be one of the world's richest men. They didn't trust he had enough cash in hand to post the bond to pay up if he is ultimately forced to. They didn't trust that they could get the money back from his properties. So Trump was on the hook of having his property seized as of yesterday. But then he got a minor reprieve when a court said, OK, you don't have to pay the full $464 million. Now let's see you come up with $175 million in a bond payment, which staves off at least for 10 days. He's got 10 days to come up with the $175 million, any action to seize property or assets.
Right. But in 3 weeks' time, he's got something else looming. The Stormy Daniels hush money affair will be heard on the 15th of April. Tell us why this is very significant, particularly timing-wise.
Well, the significance of the case is that it was Donald Trump interfering in the 2016 election, allegedly. The reason why this is the case is because the payment to Stormy Daniels was to cover up, to buy her silence over sexual encounters they had had a decade earlier. And those payments were made just a few weeks before the vote. The New York Manhattan District Attorney finally brought the charges against Trump, saying 34 counts of business malpractice, because the business records of the Trump Organization were falsified, allegedly, to cover up those payments. And the district attorney, Alvin Bragg, said this is a felony, not a misdemeanor charge, because you were using this as part of effectively electoral violations, that you were violating campaign finance law by making these payments to Stormy Daniels and hoping no one would ever find out with weeks to go before the election what had happened.
And this, of course, is a criminal case and being heard by the state, so he couldn't overturn it or pardon himself if he were president again.
Absolutely right. So this comes up through New York State. There is another state case which could not be overturned if Trump was convicted. That is the case in Georgia alleging fraud in trying to overturn the 2020 election. And then there are the two federal cases, one of which involves that attempt to overturn the 2020 election, the other the theft of classified documents. Those in theory could be overturned by Trump if he was convicted and then became president in January 2025.
And Scott, just very quickly to wrap up, what does all this mean for the elections?
It means that Trump doesn't have the imminent headline blow of people going into Trump Tower and seizing the property and saying it's now the property of the New York State. It means he doesn't have the immediate blow of being basically disqualified from doing business in New York State. But it still is a dent, not with his base, who will follow him come hell or high water. But it's a dent in that impression that he's ridden for years, which is, I'm the billionaire. I'm the star of The Apprentice. That's why you should elect me president. The billionaire ain't got billions right now. And he certainly has not got a clean business record.
Scott, thank you very much indeed. That was Scott Lucas, adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute, University College Dublin, and this is The Globalist. It's now time to talk tech news with David Phelan, Monocle's technology correspondent, who joins me in the studio. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning.
Apple's Department of Justice lawsuit. Now, this is something we discussed last Friday. Tell us more.
Well, this is the big suit that's been brought by the American DOJ against Apple, saying that it has abused its market position and acted like a monopoly. And it's a very big, it's an 88-page document. I've only read some of it, I'll be honest. But the more that is learnt about it, the more it seems that it is a confusing suit, to say the least. Accusing Apple of being a monopoly is one thing. They do have a 50% market share in America, but about 25% worldwide, so that's tricky. But there's lots of details that make no sense. Amazon made a phone called the Fire Phone. I quite liked it, actually, but it didn't do well. And the Department of Justice is saying it's because of Apple that Amazon had to exit the smartphone market. The same for Microsoft. Neither of these things is true. These were Android phones, and the success of Android is to do with that. But the more it goes on, the more uncertain it seems that the Department of Justice will have that it no longer seems like a shoo-in that the DOJ will succeed.
Yeah. And what about things like smartwatches?
Yes, this is one of the things they also focused on, saying that smartwatches, apart from the Apple Watch, do not work as well with the iPhone as the Apple Watch does. In other words, there are extra features that Apple is reserving in its hardware in the iPhone just for Apple Watch. Apple says that that's down to security and privacy. They could not get Android watches to work with the same level of privacy as the Apple Watch, so they did not support it fully.
And it's something to do with the chip here.
Well, I think it is. It's more to do with you. It is exactly that. You don't want an outside company to access the secret source of the hardware if it risks damaging privacy and security.
Let's talk about the security company Arlo, because there's some quite breaking news here.
Yes. Yesterday, Arlo announced a whole new range of security cameras, home security cameras, called the Essential Range. This is one of them. This is the outdoor camera. It's a chunky little white lozenge, and it's a new design, different from their previous ones. But what's interesting about it is that although it's an essential, it has a spotlight on the front, it has a siren, and it has capabilities for features such as colour night vision, which you don't normally get on a basic camera. And indeed, it has 2K resolution instead of 1080p, in other words, much higher resolution. A resolution is a difficult thing. The higher the resolution, the better the picture, but the bandwidth means it's not so easy to transmit it to your mobile phone when you're checking in on your camera from the other side of the world.
And it's at a pretty good price point too.
Yes, the UK prices start at £160 for two, or £200 for two for that one, which is the 2K version.
I've got to say, it's a lovely, sleek little design, isn't it?
Yes, I think it's their nicest design so far. And Arlo's cameras have always been really good, but they've sometimes been quite expensive, and this is really bucking that trend.
Yeah, right. And on to Fujifilm. It's a new camera.
Yes, I wish I was showing you it in person, but I don't have it. But that gives you an idea of what it looks like. It's a very classic
old-school camera.
Exactly. Yeah. But with a 40-megapixel sensor and a fixed lens in it. Fujifilm had a huge success with the X100V, so successful they could never meet demand. It was always on back order. This is the X106. It comes out on Thursday worldwide, in the UK the following Saturday. But what I wanted to mention was the special edition. Fujifilm is 90 years old. It began in 1934, so there's 1,934 of these special edition ones. They don't look that different, but they look... They're the most beautiful camera I've ever seen. And they're sold out already around the world, apart from in the UK, where they have very cleverly decided that it would be fairer to have a digital ballot. And in fact, if you sign up to get into this digital ballot, you're in with a chance of being able to buy one of the 110 special edition cameras that will be available in the UK.
And that opens in about 3 minutes.
Yes, that's right.
and they'll cost also £1,934.
Yes, that's right.
Absolutely. Yeah. In terms of the product, what makes the picture different?
Well, what's really interesting is that people have switched so much to using their camera phones, smartphones as cameras, and we absolutely take that for granted. But what no smartphone can match is the size of the pixels on the sensor, because the sensors have to be tiny to fit into the camera in a phone. This has a big sensor, 40 megapixels, as I say, and it has a great image stabilization on board, and it just shows a trend for people taking a little more care about their pictures. And of course, you cannot beat the ergonomics of a camera over a flat piece of glass and metal in a phone.
Absolutely. David Phelan, thank you very much for joining us. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks very much to our producers, Christy O'Grady and Laura Kramer, our researcher, George Ruskin, and our studio manager, Lily Austin. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing will be live at midday in London, and The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.